Welcome, listeners, to a new episode of the CASE podcast. Today, we will have a conversation about software engineering for the topic responsible web applications. And to do that, I've invited Joy Herron. Hi, Joy.
Hi.
So Joy is a senior consultant at InnoQ. She's also well known for her contributions to the CASE podcast, the very podcast you're listening to right now. And she's a full stack developer, and she has a lot of thoughts about good front end development and good front end principles. And that will be our topic for today. But before we get into that, we probably need to talk about the word responsible web applications, because it sounds like I've mispronounced something maybe, but I have not. So can you explain what responsible web applications are and what it means?
Yes, it actually comes from a mistake that I made. So if you feel like you accidentally said something incorrectly, it's not completely wrong. When the term actually came from when I was trying to say, internally, I wanted to show some colleagues some tips and tricks that I've picked up over the years for writing applications which are responsive and accessible. And when you say responsible and accessible, I just did it right now. If you say responsive and accessible too long and too fast, it comes out responsible. And so it was kind of a mistake when I said it the first time, but I think it works actually. Because I feel like we as web developers do have a responsibility to make sure that our applications work on every device. That's what responsive web applications mean, and for every user, which is what accessible applications mean. So the word responsible, I think it really works. It's a great marketing term as well, which you know, I wish I came up with it on purpose. I didn't, but I do think it really works for what I want to talk about. Yeah.
Awesome. So if we hear responsive and accessible, a lot of people might think, okay, those are both important, but do they have something in common? What is the reason to look at them together? What do you answer to that?
I think they actually, the more I've kind of delved into the topic, the more I've found that they do have a lot in common. I find that the way you think about developing a web application to make it responsive is often very similar to the way you think about an application in order to make it accessible. And not always the same thoughts, but they complement each other. If you make an application which is accessible, that means essentially that you are structuring your, most of the time, the basis is that you're structuring your HTML in a really good way so that the HTML is can be understood from any device or assistive technology or whatever you're using, and that adds a great basis. So for when you're talking about responsive web applications, which is when you look at what are the content that I have on my page, and how can I make them kind of squish to fill the space that I have, and so the structure of the accessibility, the structure of the HTML. Really makes a great basis for writing CSS to ensure that the application works on any device. I really like how the two play together.
But they are still like independent things. Like they have something in common and they have a similar basis, but they still require separate thoughts about them, right?
They do. There are separate concepts, I would say. I would say there's if you're doing like a Venn diagram where you have accessibility on one side, responsive behavior on another side, there's certain things that would only be dealing with accessibility and certain things that would only be dealing with responsiveness of a website. But it turns out you can find a great number of solutions which make it easy to have it be both responsive and accessible at the same time. So you're kind of killing two birds with one stone at that point in time.
Great.
So it is two different things that you need to consider and have in the back of your mind. But they play really, really well together.
Great. Okay, cool. So then let's get started with responsive web design. We both work as consultants, and in my experience, the requirements are often defined by the client, right? So a lot of clients say that they don't really need responsive web design. What would you say to that?
I would say, so I actually made a law, my first law of Joy's first law of web development is that there is no such thing as a non-responsive web application. And I think when clients come with this kind of thought, they are coming from the idea, like, you know, maybe 10, 15 years ago, how people built responsive web applications. They built it in a way where it was really expensive. It's like you had to build a whole separate website just for the mobile applications. And then you had a separate, completely separate website for a desktop application. So it was like you're building the same application twice. And so client thinks like, oh, I'm going to be able to cut costs by saying we don't need responsive behavior. Yeah. But in my experience, it's just not true that you don't need responsive behavior. It's in every single instance that I've ever experienced while developing a web application, there was always like, oh yeah, we don't need a mobile website because everybody will be accessing this on their desktop, and now we know all of our users and they all have a desktop computer, and that's true until it isn't true. And that's the thing. Mm. So that can be, you know, that's our requirement. But then 8 months into the project, you know, 2 years into the project, whenever it occurs, there will always be some kind of requirement that comes, you know, like maybe a user accidentally opens your web application on their tablet or on their phone and it looks bad. They're going to think it's broken. They aren't going to think, you know, well, this only works on desktop unless you would, I don't know, if you were crazy enough to write that on your web application, this doesn't work on viewports smaller than, you know, smaller than 270 pixels. But, you know, that just doesn't actually match with my experience of reality. In reality, users like to they will use your web application everywhere. They'll try to use it everywhere. And even if you're working on a desktop computer, we often make our browsers smaller. And it'd be nice if the content would also move to fit into that smaller browser window so that we can have more than one window open on our desktop. So that's what I say. There is just no such thing as a non-responsive web application.
I think that this notion is a lot more common in applications that you develop for internal purposes of a customer, right? So if they previously had some application for their call center or something that is used by employees, so the employees are the customers, this notion of non-responsive applications is, in my experience, much more common than customer-facing applications where this is like probably widely accepted, I would say. But like even for those applications, for the reasons you mentioned, it doesn't make a lot of sense to not make it responsive. I think that it's always funny when you are in the meeting where everyone's sitting there with their smartphone and they say like, no, we don't need this. And I'm like, okay, what do you never want to visit that page with your application? But I think it's from the mindset of those desktop applications that they are replacing, right? So they beforehand they had maybe something like a Java Swing application, and now they want to replace it with a web application, and maybe that's the reason why they are thinking this way, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, but in my experience, and that's my second law of the web development.
Yeah,
I have to have two. So Joy's second law of web development is that any work you do now to ensure that your web application behaves responsively, it will be appreciated in the future. So when a customer comes to me and says, we only need desktop, you know, I'll say, I don't believe you. But even if I don't tell them that, I will tell them that. I will just say, that's not true. But even if, you know, if we're not, we don't have to optimize for mobile to make it work on mobile. That's kind of a two separate things. So we can, you know, make it work for the desktop version the best, but still make it kind of work for mobile. So to lay the basis so that it can be used on mobile devices in the future. Mm-hmm. I do this in every project I do. So the customer comes, say, oh, we don't really need responsive behavior. I say, okay, I build it anyway, because it's not much harder than building an application which is non-responsive. And then later they come and then they're like, oh, you know, we have this requirement. The customer just told us they need to use it on their tablets. And then I'm like, okay, well, it works on your tablet, so mm-hmm. fine. I have a little anecdote. Oh, we once, I was working on an application, which they said, we know our user group, they never work on a monitor which is less than 27 inches. Mm-hmm. It might have been 25 inches or something like that, but it's like, you know, a very big screen, so we don't need to optimize for mobile. And then like a month before it was supposed to be shown at a really important Messe. Mm-hmm. What's Messe in English?
Roadshow, trade show.
Yeah, trade show. Sorry.
Yeah.
I speak fluent English. So it was going to be shown at a very important trade show. And then the marketing department said, oh, yeah, we bought four iPads to show the application on. We're uh-huh. like, oh, no. But since it worked on iPads, it was fine, you know?
Okay.
And that's what I'm saying. That's my second law of development. Even if the customer says there's no need for responsive behavior on your web application, just build it anyway. Just do it.
So you said it like in a sentence, but can you still explain, what do you think is the additional cost that a responsive web design has over like fixed with web design nowadays?
Nowadays, I would say it's approximately twice as expensive. Mm-hmm. And my mm-hmm. reasoning for that is, this is just obviously it's just a guess.
Yeah.
But the reason is that if you build a fixed width application and then you find out you have responsive behavior, you're basically going to have to rebuild everything from scratch.
Yeah.
So you might, the second time around, it might be a little bit less expensive because you already have some basic things in the background. You might not have to redo the whole back end, for instance, but you have to redo all of the work in the front end in order to get it done. And it is, and you have to migrate the old front end to the new front end, and it's just time consuming and expensive. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you build in responsive behavior from the very beginning, then that just doesn't happen. So it may be that there is a slight more expense if your developers aren't familiar with responsive web development. Like mm-hmm. there might be a small delay in cost of learning. It's possible.
Yeah.
But that learning is kind of a very good investment, in my opinion, because mm-hmm. it's something that will be able to be transferred to any other projects that you have in the future. So that's only like a short, maybe there's possible it might be a tiny bit more expensive to do it mobile now. It might take a tiny bit longer to test it on multiple viewports now. But over the long term, you will have an application that just works on all mm-hmm. different kind of devices without having to really think about it. And you won't have to build three different versions of the website for different viewports. You just have one. And it's a less code base to maintain in the long run. You don't have to migrate your application. So it's a lot cheaper.
Okay, awesome. So one of the principles in web development is this approach called mobile first. Mm-hmm. Would you say that this is part of your approach, or is it different from your approach?
That's how I would usually build a responsive web application. So for me, mobile first basically means I take content which I format it how it would look on mobile first, and then mm-hmm. on a desktop device, which has a larger viewport, I can move the content around so that it takes up, you know, more space. I have more space to use, so I can kind of restructure the elements better. And that works usually better than the other way around. So mm-hmm. because on mobile, you're usually placing your content in a, like a vertical column. If you go to my website, responsibleweb.app, there's a little widget you can play with that kind of shows it, but it's like there may be five or six content areas on your mobile site, which on mobile, you just place them, you know, vertically underneath mm-hmm. each other. And then on a desktop where there's more space, you can then move those areas around to fit in different positions, which I personally find works a lot better than if you were to say on a desktop device, I have these six different areas and then I have to squish them down to, to work on a mobile device, which I guess it would maybe be the same product in the end if your brain works that way. But I personally find it much easier to think the other way around. So I work, you know, first for the mobile representation, and then I make it a bit different on a desktop device.
Awesome. Okay. So this is because like the more capabilities your device has, being screen size or performance or stuff like that, the more you add, but it's much harder to take things away later, yes, right?
Exactly.
Okay. Awesome. When I think about responsive web applications, one thing that comes to mind are breakpoints. Like especially mm-hmm. if you use something like Bootstrap, they have predefined breakpoints for tablet, phone, mm-hmm. Desktop, big desktop, and so on. Is that the way you would view responsive web design, or is that something that's different from what you would do nowadays?
Yes. mm-hmm. Short answer, yes. I go into it a bit. The way I develop responsive web applications, which is not, I don't know, there may be other methods that will work, but what I usually do is I first focus on the layout. This is maybe going a little bit to the accessible point, which we will talk about more later. But mm-hmm. I look first at the semantic HTML of my layout. What different, you know, areas I can use, a main area, header area, footer area, side, like you can use sides for sidebar areas. And so I look at, you know, what content am I really going to have in my mm-hmm. In my application? And I look at it, you know, we said before, I usually do mobile first, so I'll have like a think, okay, on mobile, these areas will need to be maybe positioned over, like vertically over each other. And then on desktop, they will need to be, you know, positioned differently. And so what I do is I have two parts to how I develop responsive web applications. The first is that I call them responsive layout containers. So I define really with CSS, with CSS Grid, as my
tool of choice.
CSS of choice.
Yeah.
Which is, you can, it's pretty easy nowadays with CSS Grid to do this. You can just define, you know, from a certain breakpoint, these layout areas, which are kind of generic. I don't mm-hmm. really maybe know what's going to end up in that specific area, but I can define on the container level, I can define, I will have these different areas and I want them on mobile to be all vertically aligned. And then on the larger viewports, I want them to be positioned differently to maybe have a main content area, to have a sidebar, to have a header, this kind of thing. And so I have usually one breakpoint in my CSS, which means that from this point on, please switch the layout so that then their sidebar is positioned next to the main content. Mm-hmm. So then I'll just choose a breakpoint. I think, I don't know if I link it in my article. I can, I don't think I do, but I can, so we can link in the show notes. There's one article that I usually use about how we can choose breakpoints, how we can choose breakpoints based on device size. The best way is to choose a breakpoint, which is, for instance, bigger than the biggest tablet portrait, but smaller mm-hmm. than the smallest, rotated tablet, Netscape portrait. You know, you can choose a breakpoint in between so that on most devices, you'll have a smooth transition. But that's what I do. So that's the first step I do is I define really a skeleton, a structure. Mm-hmm. And then that's my responsive container. And then what I do is that all of the elements that I place in those different areas of my layout, those I call them squishy components. So I make sure those components, every component will squish to fit the space that's available. So there's a few different ways you can do that. We can maybe go into those later. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that you have these two parts. So the layout itself is responsive. It will change at a certain breakpoint. And then I have these content areas, which are kind of generic HTML containers. And I can just place different HTML components in those layout areas and make sure that the components themselves will squish to fit the space that they have available.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Before we get into that, can we just recap the CSS grid part? Like, can mm-hmm. I use that today, or is it still not supported far enough? And what is my fallback if it doesn't?
Yeah, so that's one of the things that's wonderful about, they call it progressive enhancement. So CSS mm-hmm. grid is actually supported in every major browser nowadays. It's mm-hmm. not supported in Internet Explorer 11. But it is supported in, you know, Android, telephone, iPhone, all of, you know, Firefox, Safari, Chrome, Opera, I would assume, Edge. It's, mm-hmm. it's supported everywhere. So you can use it. It's been around for at least 2 years, at least I feel, that it's been pretty well supported.
Yeah.
But the nice thing about CSS is that if CSS grid isn't supported, the nice thing is that your fallback, which is probably your mobile layout, where all mm-hmm. of the elements are placed vertically, one, you know, after another, that will still work in Internet Explorer 11. Mm-hmm. So unless you have a really great reason why you need Internet Explorer 11, which, you know, if you're have an enterprise customer and they have a pre-installed Internet Explorer 11 that all users use, then yeah, you probably need to maybe reach for some other layout mechanisms. But the fallback would just be the normal layout. It would just be the vertical layout, which works, you know, it works on your phone. It also works in a browser which doesn't understand CSS grid. So it has a nice fallback. You don't have to worry about using it.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I find it funny that you said like it's there for at least 2 years. And I remember in my first years as a front-end web developer, 2 years were like, it's only there for 2 years because browser upgrade cycles were so much slower. But I think like, mm-hmm. especially due to auto-upgrading browsers,
yes.
I think we can switch to newer things much earlier mm-hmm. than we could like 5 or 10 years ago because they are just getting upgraded, right? Because yes. Internet Explorer 6, it was there for years and years and years, and there were no upgrades or auto-upgrades to a newer version. There wasn't even a newer version. But nowadays, Chrome is getting upgraded like every 3 weeks, and Firefox mm-hmm. is the same thing, right? And as a user, you don't even notice that this is happening, right? Even mm-hmm. even for enterprise settings where the browser's upgraded. But that's great to know that it's white supported.
Yeah, but even then, I actually personally like to try out new CSS features. Mm-hmm. I did a case podcast with Rachel Andrew. We can link that in the show notes. Mm-hmm. She also talked about, you know, some newer CSS features, and we can use them as long as we ensure that the base variant also looks good. Mm-hmm. I think Andy Bell on Twitter, he talked about minimal viable experience or something like that. I can mm-hmm. look up the tweet. Maybe I can find it. And if we can, we can put it in the show notes. But I like that this idea that we develop, you know, the base of our CSS, we can make it look nice. Even if we're using some feature, you know, on a modern browser which understands aspect ratio, for instance, that just came out. Most browsers even now won't understand it, but we can make it, you know, normal without aspect ratio, and then set the CSS rule. And so as soon as the browser does understand it, suddenly you have a better layout without you actually having to do anything or deploy anything. So I think that's one of my my favorite things about CSS, is that you can try out all these new things. And as long as you make sure that the fallback is nice, you don't have to actually worry about a bad user experience for your users if they don't have the most modern browser.
Yeah, I think a good example for that would be also the navigation you have on the responsible web app site. It doesn't have anything to do with responsive or accessible web apps, but you used an effect where it like flows around a circle, right? And this would also fall back quite nicely on an older browser, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
Now I'm hoping I actually tested that, but I think so. Yeah. It is a float. And so I think that uses CSS shapes. So I think if CSS shapes is not supported, then it would just float as if it were around a box. So I think it would be fine. Yeah.
Yeah. If I deactivate it, it's just like it's straight down. It's not following the shape, but it's like a straight left and right thing. Yeah. So I think that works. Cool. So you mentioned squishy components, which is a pretty nice word and untranslatable to German. I've tried though. How do you implement a squishy component? You already said what it is, but how do you implement it?
Yeah, so there's different methods. I don't know if we can link to that specific section in the show notes, or if the users can just go to responsibleweb.app and go to the section. There's different ways, like with Flexbox, for instance. Maybe I'll just list out a few. So if you're using Flexbox for displaying content, you can just use Flex Wrap, which means that if the items in your Flexbox no longer fit within the space, they'll just wrap onto the next line and continue continue on the next line. And you can also nest Flexboxes inside of each other. So to get some nice responsive behavior, you can use Flexbox to make the content just fit in the space that it has available. So I personally like using Flexbox as long as I'm basically styling things in one dimension. There's Flexbox and CSS Grid. So one question some people ask is, when do I use Flexbox? When do you use CSS Grid? I personally often like to use Flexbox when it's just on one axis. I know I'm either positioning elements horizontally or I'm positioning them vertically. Then Flexbox is quite flexible.
Yeah.
Makes sense. You know.
Makes sense.
You know. Exactly. And so that's one option. With Flexbox, you have a lot of options for making the content just squish down to fit into the available space. And there's some other options. So there's also CSS Grid has a function which is called, I call it an intrinsic grid, but basically you can use a grid template columns that rule with repeat and autofill. And then no matter how many elements you place inside of this container, CSS or the HTML container, they will just fill the grid. So they'll create a grid with as many columns as are available, which is really nice if you're doing something like generating a page with a bunch of cards, that look like cards, like links to articles or different things. You can do that with an intrinsic grid. So that means that the grid itself will collapse if you make the viewport smaller, and then probably on a mobile grid, you only have one column, but in a larger viewport, 2, 3, 4, as many as fit within the space. So that's another method. One I have on the site, I think I have 4 in total. That doesn't mean those are the only 4 that you can use to make a component squishy.
Yeah.
But one I use is like a horizontal scroll container, which basically means that you just set overflow X to be auto. And that means that the component, the box itself stays the same size as the layout requires, But if you put larger content inside of that box, it'll just activate a scroll bar. So I use that a lot when we're developing enterprise applications. We might be developing applications with a lot of tables and this kind of thing. And tables are notoriously difficult to make squishy. I mean, you can do it. It's just a bit more work. That's not one of the quick tricks you can use. But often, often a table is still, as long as you can scroll it horizontally, it's still usable on a mobile device. So if you just place that table inside of like a scrollable container, that means that that on a mobile device, you can actually still view the content, which is what's important. Yeah. Otherwise, what happens is if you don't make your components squishy, like with tables, what will happen is that by default, most most like a CSS layout container, if the content doesn't fit in the box, like, you know, if a mobile device says, put the table go in this box, and then the table says, no, I'm going to jump out of the box, then it messes up the whole layout. So usually the nav bar above doesn't quite fit, you know, it squishes all of the other content to the left so that it tries to fit the table or something like that.
Yeah, it's also something that happens is that on your phone, it's bigger than the screen for some reason. And then it's a very weird user experience because you can scroll a bit to the right, the entire screen, and everything's a bit off, right? Which is
Yeah, so I just don't like that. It's like, like one of those, when I see that, I'm like, no, horizontal scroll. It's at least, you know, at least the content itself is in its own little box that scrolls.
Yeah. But what's your experience there with scrolling scroll bars? Because like nowadays, most browsers hide the scroll bars for a reason I'm not entirely sure about. Like most people expect that they can scroll down the entire page, but do they also expect that they can scroll inside this tiny bar horizontally?
I'm not exactly sure. I feel like if the this is maybe just me as a user, if the content is obviously cut off, then it may look like it's scrollable and the user may try. You can also add sometimes a box shadow, like an internal box shadow to a scrollable container, which makes it look like you can see that there might be some content to the right if you scroll. So that's one thing you can't do. You need to just look and see, how does it look? Is it obvious? Can you tell that it's scrollable? If it's not obvious that it's scrollable, you might need to add some kind of shadows or something, or some icon, I don't know, to maybe indicate that they can scroll.
Maybe that's something you need to do a little user test for your specific application, right? To see if people understand that they can scroll there, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. And the last part are the squishy texts, right?
Yeah, that's just kind of, I threw that on there. It's a little bit of a collection of different things which can help your text to break. So one problem is if you, most content is squishy by default, but some like text will not break by default. So it's like the typical, you know, CSS meme, and CSS is awesome, and awesome is sticking out of the box because the box has a width, and awesome is longer than the width. But there is some methods like with hyphens, some kind of modern CSS. It's like hyphens, overflow wrap, word wrap, and these things. So word wrap and word breaker, older CSS properties. And there's some, you know, WebKit specific CSS as well there that I listed on the site, which will just activate hyphenation for your text. So if it does break, then it will break and fit within the box. It is worth noting maybe I think it's based on sometimes the browser decides where it's hyphenated. So the browsers need to have dictionaries installed sometimes to hyphenate correctly, but I think modern browsers do that pretty well, and even Internet Explorer 11. As long as you're, you know, viewing a German website on a German computer, they also do hyphenation. So
Awesome. Yeah, I think like you mentioned that by default, the browser is pretty responsive, which is, I think, one of the interesting things about web development, because if you don't add any CSS at all, your page will be responsive, right? It's always kind of our fault if it's not, right?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, most content, if it doesn't fit in the box, it just squishes. That's what it does.
Yeah.
You don't usually have to say anything else.
Cool. Yeah. Okay. I think we covered like most of the responsive part, right? So we have a lot of cool tools, especially Flexbox and CSS Grid can help us a lot.
I should mention that that Chrome is right now working on container queries, which is extremely exciting.
Do you want to share your happiness about that?
I'm very excited. So yes, I want to share my happiness. But I don't know the exact spec yet. I've been trying to follow along and read a little bit, but I'm just really excited that it's actually being worked on right now. That will be like, you'll be able to write, I don't know what the syntax will be, but you'll be able to say add container is similar to how you would write a media query. You would write, this container, you would write a container and then like a min width 60 pixels or whatever you're using, or 15 rem or... and then you can kind of change the layout of your component based on the amount of space it actually has, not based on the width of the viewport. So what a lot of times will happen is when we're working on this kind of responsive design, we have, you know, our responsive layout outside, and then we'll switch from, you know, a vertical layout to a layout with a sidebar and a main content area. And there's certain viewports where that main content area is actually smaller than it is on the viewport, which is 1 pixel smaller because of the switch. And so with this kind of container queries, you would make the component that you put in that content area, you would make that respond to the width that it has available and not the width which you have for your viewport. So it's really exciting. It's been one of like the most requested feature for CSS for a really long time. So I'm really happy that some people are working on it right now.
Yeah, that's pretty great. I think like the reason it took so long is because it's really complicated to implement it very cool feature that works well and is also working on slower devices and stuff like that, right? So
Yeah, but they also like them. Like with CSS, you have to, I don't really understand the details that go into the background, but with CSS, you have to make sure, you know, that there's, you know, recursion that could happen if you modify a component to make sure it doesn't, you know, recur unendlessly, or, you know, the performance isn't horribly bad, or you're triggering layout rewrites every single time you change the layout, this kind of thing. It's a very complicated problem. And so it's something that they're working on, and I'm very excited to see what solutions they come up with.
Cool. Okay, so let's get into accessibility. Accessibility is a broad field. There are different kinds of accessibility needs that people have that visit our web pages. I think your focus is a bit on blind users, right? So there are other accessibility things like contrast, for example, that are also very important, but that's not your focus in this article, right?
Yes, I listed out some things, but I didn't list out everything you need to be accessible. I tried to make it clear these are just some tips and tricks. Yeah. So the focus, one of my main tools for testing accessibility is a screen reader. So a lot of the things that I mentioned are things, you know, that you can easily find out with a screen reader.
Yeah.
But it also helps, you know, that the two main, like if you can make something screen reader accessible and keyboard accessible, and also pay attention to, you know, contrast and things, then you've done a good job. You know, it's a good start. It's a good start. So the to be accessible, the tips and tricks I list on the site are not exhaustive by any means.
Yeah.
But they're necessary.
Yeah.
And so I think with learning a little bit, we as developers can can stop making stupid mistakes, frankly, and just think about people who might be using our web application who don't use it the same way we do.
Yeah.
And then we can make it maybe 80% accessible. Mm-hmm. Maybe we don't have the skills to make it 100% perfect.
Yeah.
But we can get pretty far if we know some basics. And that's kind of what I wanted to convey on this website. I feel like I'm learning new things about accessibility all the time. And so it was, yeah, I had people check, you know, like if the things I list on the site are correct, and yes, they are.
Okay.
But I also feel like I also know there's other things I don't know, but I feel like those points that I listed are a good starting point, kind of as a checklist. Mm-hmm. If you do these things, you're gonna do better than if you don't do these things.
Yeah. Yeah. I view them as kind of like best practices, right? Like is the same way that you want to have some security best practices because you don't want to make stupid security mistakes, right? But at some point you need an expert on that that does a review or an audit of your application and that will find like the last 20 or 10% that are missing, right? But you don't want to have a security audit that tells you are vulnerable to CSERF attacks, right? That would be like the baseline that you just want to make sure works without any audits. But like if you want to go the extra mile and make it really accessible or really secure, you need an expert to do an audit, right?
Yes, and that's the thing is like with this, when we're developing applications that are accessible, you know, you do need, if you want to make sure that your application works for screen readers, you need a screen reader user to test it.
Yeah.
There's just no way to get around that. But if you learn enough about screen readers to be able to use your web application using a screen reader, then you can make sure, for instance, that you can navigate to every element with your keyboard, you know, that you can find a lot of really elementary mistakes and ensure that it's mostly accessible.
Yeah.
And so because otherwise, if you're asking, you know, you asking screen reader user to test your application for you, and they may not be able to use it at all.
Yeah,
it's possible, and then you don't get any information. But if you can figure out the basic things, then you can focus on the fine tuning and the user experience. So one thing about accessibility that I like to mention is that if you can make a web application accessible, you always, I'm going to say always, it's a very large statement, but then the user experience is so much improved for almost any user. If you can make sure, you know, that your site is able to be navigated, for instance, like you have links like to be able to move around your web application, it makes a great user experience. And this is kind of where accessibility and responsive design can kind of play nicely with each other. So if you consider on a mobile device, like one point is that you can one point I have in this accessible web design section is to use a nav element, which is an HTML element, and you can use that to provide links that allow your user to navigate, not like within the actual page, so not only, you know, two other pages on your website, but actually two different heading areas on your page. And this is actually often, I found, I developed a web application with a colleague, which we used for our last event. And that was, it's called Spacey. It's an application which we developed so that it's accessible, and it's to collect different ideas from a whole bunch of colleagues and do open space moderation remotely. So everybody can just put like in an open space, you write a topic on a post-it note and then place it on a board. So basically we mocked that up and made it also accessible. So like a web application that does this accessibly. But I found that there was a lot of overlaps between that accessibility and the mobile design of the site. So for instance, if I'm with mobile, we're also often on a smaller device, for instance, and we may at a certain point, like if we're scrolled all the way to the bottom of our device, we may be in an area of the web page where we don't see what happens at the top of the web page. You know, and at that same point, we want a link to be able to link to that top, to be able to spring to the top. And that's kind of the, so that if we add that, we would add that for a screen reader user, for instance, so that they can spring around the page. But we can also, you know, for mobile devices, we can also show that to the user, and it's also helpful. So it improves the overall user experience of the website as well.
Yeah. And another example for that would also be the main tag, right? Because it's also used by this reader mode. A lot of the web browsers nowadays offer to give you focus on the content, right? So can you maybe explain what those landmarks are, what they help us do?
Yeah, so the landmarks are, the main landmarks are main, header, and footer. And you can also use a side. And those basically, those two, especially main, header, and footer, those three are HTML landmarks. So those should come directly as the direct child of your body element. And what that does is that it will add a layer of navigation to an assistive technology. So for a screen reader or another assistive technology, they will be able to provide the user with a menu of kind of links. Here's the main content, here's the header. You know, they can maybe shortcuts, they can navigate directly there. And so that just adds a layer, it gives information about where that is. So when we're developing web applications, we could, you know, a lot of web developers just use a div element for everything. But here we have HTML elements which have a specific purpose, and they add a layer of meaning, and it also makes your HTML easier to read, which is an added benefit. So that's what a landmark region is. I think there may be other landmarks that you can also add to your HTML markup. You can research it.
Cool. So I think like one of the things that is different for a screen reader user than for a sighted user is that you cannot glimpse into other areas of the page quite easily. So you need some way to jump between things or get an overview of your web page. How can we help users doing that in our web applications?
Well, I usually use links to do that. So that would mean that I just place a link if I think the user might need to get from this area of my web application to this area of the web application. I can add
anchor link.
Anchor link, thank you. So I add an ID to the specific section that I want to link to, and then I can add an anchor link linking with a hash. And then I can just, if the user clicks on the link, automatically they will move to that area of the web application. And so, as I said, that's something that's also work that also improves the usability for mobile as well.
Very cool. And headings, do they also help with that? Can they offer some structure or something?
I think headings don't offer. They offer structure in the sense they just offer the information structure. So they also allow. I think with a screen reader, you can view an overview of all the headings on the page. It's good to use headings, which are obvious what it means. Like it actually describes what it is at that specific part on the page. And what's really important with headings is that you don't ever skip heading levels. I'm saying that because I am a developer, and I know the first time I was working with headings, I was like, okay, I'm going to use this H1 tag, but the H2 is too big. It's visually just doesn't look right. So I'm going to use an H4. And then I was like, how bad is it? And I didn't understand. So I had to read up on it.
Yeah.
I didn't understand is that the heading levels are not intended to look like anything. The H2 levels are intended to provide a clear, documented structure of your document. So it should be like your table of contents should be your heading level. So you can have, we should have one H1 for the page. Then you have a different heading levels, H2 elements, which are maybe the main sections. And then you can have under H2 levels, you can have an H3, you know, maybe a few H3s to break it up, but never skip from like an H1 directly to an H4, because what that happens, if you're going through the content and the user is just only has the content and they go from the H1 level to the H4, they're going to think that they are missing two heading levels. Like, where's the content gone? You know, they're going to think you made a mistake. They're not going to think, it's possible, very possible that someone would get confused.
Yeah.
So it's definitely very important. So what you can do instead is you can style your headings based on, you can style an H2 to look like an H6, or, you know, it doesn't have to be big. It doesn't, but it needs to be an H2. That's the point.
Cool. Okay. So one thing that is also quite inaccessible for a lot of people are forms, right? Because there are certain trends right now that make them even more inaccessible than they used to be. Can you give us a few hints about how to design our forms in a way that they are accessible to people?
So the one trick, trick is like common sense, but always use a label element. It's one thing that is very important, and one thing that is often done wrong. And that is that use a label element for every input field that you have. So you can either wrap your input field, add a label as a container around your input field, with the text. So that you know that the label belongs to the input. Or even a little bit better is if you have a label which uses the for attribute and an ID. The for attribute should reference the ID of the input field. That it is referencing. And that's very important because when someone is navigating the page, first of all, for screen reader users, if you navigate the page and you just land inside an input field, if the input field has a label, that label will be read out to the user. So it's like an extra, it adds the information, it tells the user, what does this input field do? Because otherwise, if you're in an input field, it'll just say, edit text. In VoiceOver, for instance, it says, edit text. And you're like, well, that's not helpful. What text am I editing?
Yeah.
You know, so adding the label will tell you what text you're editing. But not only that, it's also extremely important for users who, just any user, frankly, but especially important for users who may be have difficulty concentrating, for instance, because with labels which don't have forms, that usually means they misuse the placeholder attribute to make the text, the label, appear in the input field, and then when the user clicks in the field, that text disappears. So if a user has difficulty concentrating, what may happen is they click in the field, the text disappears, and then they're like, wait, what am I doing?
Yeah.
You know, what was it that I was supposed to input here? And the other thing is if you think about just frankly, just usability of the page, if you put in, you know, they put in the fill out the whole form, maybe they submit it, and something's wrong. You know, the typical user experience is that the whole form will come back and it will show you the fields which are wrong. But at that point, do you remember what you put in the field? So you might get like please input a number or something. And you're like, but I don't remember what field it was. Like what number am I supposed to put in? So just always use a label with input fields. And remember, so placeholders are not intended to be labels. So they were intended to give, you know, like maybe some example information. If if the field is input name, you might put, you know, Joy Heron as a placeholder to kind of show that this is the format that we would kind of expect. It's supposed to be a help, but it's not supposed to be the main instructions. So this is especially difficult because there's some new, there's some designers who use, they're like, input fields are boring. And so they just decided to be cool with their design. And what they did is there's a, you know, there's a common design pattern, which is that when you place your cursor, you know, the label is shown over, you know, like shown as the text. It's shown like in the place where you see the text. And when the user clicks in there, the label moves up and becomes a little smaller. But it's really difficult. I mean, theoretically, you could do that with the actual label element, but it's really difficult and most people don't. And that's a big problem. And the other problem with that is that when the text is in the label, in the input field, it also looks like it's filled already. It's just, it's like, so it's bad usability. So I just would, I would say for the most part, just leave it the other typical, form field looks like a form field, which means that the label is up, like it's the label is there, and then an input field follows directly under it. It's left aligned. The input field looks like an input field, which means it's a box. It looks like you can click in it. These kind of things. So this is a common usability thing. We we shouldn't, you know, think it's boring. So let's make something, let's make some really cool design. Frankly, when it comes to form fields, boring is really, really good because, because it means that it'll be easier for users to figure out if it's like so boring that it's obvious how to use it. That's, that should be the goal for forms. It's just so boring that it's obvious that how to fill out the form.
Because boring is easy to understand, right?
It means that we've been using the patterns that we all know about. That's what it means.
Exactly. Like especially the floating label pattern or however you want to call it. I find it so weird because some people put the label inside the field because they want to save space, which I find to be not a great reason, but an understandable reason. But if you do the floating label thing, you're already reserving space for that label, right? Because you're floating it up there anyway, so why not put it there from the beginning, right? So this is something I find quite hard to understand, but this is some trend, so we need to accept that, but we don't need to accept that in the scope of accessibility. Okay, cool. So this helps us to build more accessible forms. Another topic are things that you want to show and hide. Like I have a very long page and I have certain areas that where I say this is like additional information that you only need to look at if you really want to. And one pattern for that are accordions. What can I do to build a good accordion component so that it's also usable for screen reader users?
Well, I like, there's a new newer HTML element, which you, if you aren't supporting, I think Internet Explorer 11, you could use it. And that's the details element that actually provides this exactly this behavior. So the thing is if you are showing and hiding content for users visually, you probably want to show and hide that same content for someone who is not accessing your site visually. Because it's probably not that important. So, so the details element, it's, it, you add the details element and then you add, you can add a summary inside. And so that just adds like a toggle field, which will collapse and expand the content. So that's actually the easiest way. It's, it works all the time as long as the HTML element is supported, which is, it is in all the browsers. So that's currently, I would say, it'd be nice if you could get away with using only that. I haven't actually tried to use only that in projects yet. But if you are, like, usually we have to implement this behavior in some way. And with, I have on the site, I have a custom element that I've defined, and I basically copy it between projects. Yeah. What it is it's just a toggle button. Mm-hmm. And what it does is I add the toggle button to the page. And when JavaScript is enabled, it will toggle the content. So I add an attribute to the button. I say the data target with maybe an href or something, or, you know, maybe a CSS selector. But what that does is it just will hide and collapse that content, the content that it references. And what it does is it also uses the area expand attribute. So the area expanded attribute is an attribute that you add to a button to tell the button what state is the UI currently in. I've seen that mistake made a few times, as someone thought that the area expanded attribute was what you put on the content to tell if the content was expanded or not. And that's not what it is. The area expanded attribute tells the button. It adds an information for screen readers, which will tell the screen reader, is it collapsed or expanded currently? And if it's collapsed, the user knows they can expand it. And if it's expanded, they know they can collapse it. And so that I have a little custom element that you can look at on the website. One thing I like to do is I like to also with this kind of accordion element, I personally like to make all the content. I hide the toggle button by default, and I will only activate it. And I hide the toggle button by default, and I show the content by default. And then if JavaScript is activated, I have the JavaScript remove the hidden field from the button, and then hide the content and make it the toggle button. But what that does is that if the browser doesn't support JavaScript, usually they support JavaScript to some extent, but it doesn't support that flavor of JavaScript, or there's some JavaScript error in your bundle or something else, or you just weren't able to download the JavaScript because your internet connection is really, really bad. In that instance, your content will still be available. So that's a little bit of progressive enhancement. For instance, the website itself, responsibleweb.app, it uses this content, this component in the menu. But I have an old Android device, and I tested it on the Android device, and it didn't, in quotations, it didn't work.
Yeah,
because my Android device doesn't support custom elements. It's a bit older. And I thought it was just great because it actually looked okay.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, good. I don't have to do anything. You know, the toggle button failed. But in this instance, I can just use modern JavaScript. And for older Android browsers, they won't actually know that it was supposed to collapse. So yeah. I don't really have to do anything.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, it's one thing that I always want to say about accordions is that if you include an accordion, you should probably think about, why are you hiding this content? If it's not that important, does it need to be on the page? Or maybe could you put it on a different page and link to it? Like, this is something I always feel like accordions are a bit overused, but that's just like my personal taste.
They're often used for menu buttons.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's one that usually you do kind of want. If your menu button doesn't, like your hamburger menu button is typically what it is, if that doesn't work for on your phone, but you still can see the menu items, then it's fine.
Yeah, that's true. Cool. So one important thing is always like, there might be certain things on the page that should only be visible to sighted people, and there are other things that should only be visible to screen reader users. Yes. So what is the technique there?
So first of all, so like something like sometimes there's elements in our page, which like icons, different things, which are we add to make it more clear to the users what it does. But the user, like a screen reader user, may already have all the context they need. So they don't need extra information. So what we can do then is we can use a visually hidden CSS class or Mixin or whatever we're using to just hide it visually, but still make it available in the accessibility tree. So the problem is if we were to use display none, then it would not only remove it from the visual page, it would also remove it from the screen reader. So sometimes, anyway, so then, so I always have a helper class. I linked the CSS
on the page.
I showed a CSS snippet, the one I usually use on the page. There's just some different things you can do to hide it visually. I think it's like position absolute, making it one pixel high, overflow hidden, like all these different things.
Cool. Okay. So the last topic I would see is a focus. Like, I think that's especially a problem with JavaScript heavy applications that create usability or accessibility problems. What do I need to know about focus as like a 101 course?
I will answer that, but I actually will go back because I talked about hiding content visually, but I didn't talk about the other part, which is adding contextual information only for screen readers, so that we can do that either by adding a span attribute or paragraph attribute to our page with that visually hidden class, but we can also use the area label or the area label by attribute on our HTML to add information. If it's necessary. So if it is an icon that that we need to tell the user how to use the icon, and they don't know, they can't see it, so they can't guess that it's an upload icon, we should add a label to that. Frankly, we should add a label to it even, visually in that context. But if we do have information which we need to add contextual information with a screen reader, we can use like a label, an area label, or just a visually hidden element. We're talking about focus.
Yes.
So that's just something. I think if we don't do anything with JavaScript, it's not that then just leave it. So by default, browsers add a focus style to form elements. So when you tab through a web page, it will add a focus to, usually I think it's form elements and buttons. I've configured my Safari, you can configure browsers so that they also will focus on links by default. But usually the default focus style is like a blue ring. And sometimes a designer will come, "Oh, that's so ugly. Like, you have to get rid of that." And I think in that instance, what you can tell the designer is that they need to find a great focus style. A focus style if you have like something which clearly also indicates to the user that it focuses. But often I just leave it, frankly. It's not too big of a hassle. I don't think it's usually worth the effort of testing focus styles in all the different browser combinations that it could be. It would make me really nervous to overwrite the default focus styles personally. Usually I find that I prefer to invest my time in a few other things just because I'm scared I'll miss out on some browser somewhere and the focus styles won't work so correctly. And that kind of scares me. I think on this website, though, I think I did use a focus style, so maybe but I use the same one. I use like an outline as well, but I think I use an outline as well, but I just styled it differently. It's like, I think I used a dash and maybe a different color of blue, but it's still a visual focus style. And the important thing with that is that when a user is a keyboard user, they will navigate the page and they need to know where they are when they're on the page. It's kind of if you are tabbing through the page and you don't know which form field you're in, that's just, you just can't use the page. So that's the one thing. And then if you do use JavaScript, which, yeah. I mean, I do use JavaScript for web applications. I just try to minimize it. But if you're moving, like when you do certain things with JavaScript, you also need to consider focus. So for instance, if you are, I have an example that I linked. If you're using like a pagination with JavaScript, mm-hmm. And you click on a show more button, that doesn't, like, if you think in the context, think how would a, like, if I am in this context, I click a button and I can't tell that something happened, mm-hmm. how do I know that something happened? So, in that instance, it's probably best to move the focus to the new item that's loaded in that instance. And then you can test it to make sure it works, of course, mm-hmm. test. But only do that in very, very, be very, very, don't move the focus unless you really have a good reason for doing it.
Yeah.
If you're loading new content and you think if the user clicks on this button and this new content loads and it will be useful for the user to move to that content, you can do that. You should also add, at that point, you should also add a label, like a visually hidden label, which will tell the user that they moved.
Yeah.
So that they know, kind of mimicking this behavior.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. So especially I think like wrapping up both points, it's, you should always reconsider if you are thinking about replacing a default thing that the browser offers, because the browser vendors did a lot of work to make them accessible and so on. And if you just replace them without thinking too much about them, you will probably make a mistake. And you should probably consider the cost of re-implementing them in a accessible way before doing that, right? So I think that's important.
Maybe to wrap up, I think in general, just developing applications in this way, you know, you're developing based on browser standards.
So
I like to think about it as you're developing, it's easier to support browsers that are old because you can just think about, like, especially HTML and CSS are both very stable. So if an older browser if it sees something that it doesn't understand, it ignores it if it's HTML and CSS.
Yeah.
So it's easier to create a minimal viable experience with HTML and CSS, which works. And then you can support almost any browser.
Yeah.
You know, going really far back with very minimal effort. But also, it's developing your application for the future. Browsers are well known for being backwards compatible. So if something has made it into the HTML spec or made it into the CSS spec, and I use it in my application and it works now, it will work in 10 years or 15 years, maybe even 20 years. You know, how many technologies can we say that about? This is one of the things I love developing web applications this way, because it's much easier to develop for the past. You know, even if we are using JavaScript, we use polyfills. In the future, we can just delete those polyfills. So we're upgrading our application by deleting stuff, which is great. And we're also thinking forward. Our application will look the same and work the same in 5 years as it does today. Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Cool. So my personal prediction is also that that more people will become screen reader users in the future, because we use things like Siri and so on to read stuff to us, right? So I think this is also preparing your page for the future to make them usable by voice assistants, or however you want to call them. Okay, Joy. So thank you so much for this great overview of those two very important topics. I hope to get you back on the podcast someday. And yeah, thanks for your time. And thanks for all the listeners for their time. And yeah, see you next time. Bye-bye.